Section 16 of Orlando by Virginia Woolf. This Legamus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose as long as Legamus is credited. Chapter 6, Part 2. Orlando walked up the street. Now that the poem was gone, and she felt a bare place in her breast where she had been used to carry it, she had nothing to do but reflect upon whatever she liked, the extraordinary chances it might be of the human lot. Here she was in St. James's Street, a married woman, with a ring on her finger. Where there had been a coffee-house once, there was now a restaurant. It was about 3:30 in the afternoon. The sun was shining. There were 3 pigeons, a mongrel terrier dog, 2 hansom cabs, and a barouche landau. What, then, was life? The thought popped into her head violently, irrelevantly, unless old Green was somehow the cause of it. And it may be taken as a comment, adverse or favourable, as the reader chooses to consider it, upon her relations with her husband, who was at the Horn, that whenever anything popped violently into her head, she went straight to the nearest telegraph office and wired to him. There was one, as it happened, close at hand. "My God, Shell," she wired. "Life, literature, green toady." Here she dropped into a cipher language, which they had invented between them so that a whole spiritual state of the utmost complexity might be conveyed in a word or two, without the telegraph clerk being any wiser, and added the words, "Ratigan Glumphobu," which summed it up precisely. For not only had the events of the morning made a deep impression on her, but it cannot have escaped the reader's attention that Orlando was growing up, which is not necessarily growing better. And "Ratigan Glumphobu" described a very complicated spiritual state, which, if the reader puts all his intelligence at our service, he may discover for himself. There could be no answer to her telegram for some hours. Indeed, it was probable, she thought, glancing at the sky, where the upper clouds raced swiftly past, that there was a gale at Cape Horn, so that her husband would be at the masthead, as likely as not, or cutting away some tattered spar, or even alone in a boat with a biscuit. And so, leaving the post-office, she turned to beguile herself into the next shop, which was a shop so common in our day that it needs no description, yet to her eyes strange in the extreme, a shop where they sold books. All her life long Orlando had known manuscripts. She had held in her hands the rough brown sheets on which Spenser had written in his little crabbed hand. She had seen Shakespeare's script and Milton's. She owned, indeed, a fair number of quartos and folios, often with a sonnet in her praise in them, and sometimes a lock of hair. But these innumerable little volumes, bright, identical, ephemeral, for they seemed bound in cardboard and printed on tissue paper, surprised her infinitely. The whole works of Shakespeare cost 1/2 crown, and could be put in your pocket. One could hardly read them, indeed, the print was so small, but it was a marvel, none the less. Works. The works of every writer she had known or heard of, and many more, stretched from end to end of the long shelves. On tables and chairs more works were piled and tumbled, and these she saw, turning a page or two, were often works about other works by Sir Nicholas, and a score of others, whom, in her ignorance, she supposed, since they were bound and printed, to be very great writers too. So she gave an astounding order to the bookseller to send her everything of any importance in the shop, and left. She turned into Hyde Park, which she had known of old. Beneath that cleft tree, she remembered, the Duke of Hamilton fell, run through the body by Lord Mohun. And her lips, which are often to blame in the matter, began framing the words of her telegram into a senseless sing-song. Life, literature, green, toady, Ratigan, Glumphobu. So that several park-keepers looked at her with suspicion, and were only brought to a favourable opinion of her sanity by noticing the pearl necklace which she wore. She had carried off a sheaf of papers and critical journals from the bookshop, and at length, flinging herself on her elbow beneath a tree, she spread these pages round her, and did her best to fathom the noble art of prose composition as these masters practised it. for still the old credulity was alive in her. Even the blurred type of a weekly newspaper had some sanctity in her eyes. So she read, lying on her elbow, an article by Sir Nicholas on the collected works of a man she had once known, John Donne. But she had pitched herself, without knowing it, not far from the Serpentine. The barking of a thousand dogs sounded in her ears. Carriage wheels rushed ceaselessly in a circle. Leaves sighed overhead. Now and again a braided skirt and a pair of tight scarlet trousers crossed the grass within a few steps of her. Once a gigantic rubber ball bounced on the newspaper. Violets, oranges, reds and blues broke through the interstices, broke through the interstices of the leaves and sparkled in the emerald on her finger. She read a sentence and looked up at the sky. She looked up at the sky and looked down at the newspaper. Life, literature, one to be made into the other, but how monstrously difficult! For, here came by a pair of tight scarlet trousers, how would Addison have put that? Here came two dogs dancing on their hind legs, how would Lamb have described that? For reading Sir Nicholas and his friends, as she did in the intervals of looking about her, she somehow got the impression. Here she rose and walked. They made one feel. It was an extremely uncomfortable feeling. One must never, never say what one thought. She stood on the banks of the Serpentine. It was a bronze colour. Spider-thin boats were skimming from side to side. They made one feel, she continued, that one must always, always write like somebody else. The tears formed themselves in her eyes. For really, she thought, pushing a little boat off with her toe, I don't think I could. Here the whole of Sir Nicholas's article came before her, as articles do, 10 minutes after they are read, with the look of his room, his head, his cat, his writing-table, and the time of the day thrown in. I don't think I could, she continued, considering the article from this point of view. Sit in a study. No, it's not a study. It's a mouldy kind of drawing-room, all day long, and talk to pretty young men and tell them little anecdotes, which they mustn't repeat, about what Tupper said about smiles. And then, she continued, weeping bitterly, they're all so manly. And then I do detest duchesses, and I don't like cake, and though I'm spiteful enough, I could never learn to be as spiteful as all that. So how can I be a critic and write the best English prose of my time? Damn it all, she exclaimed, launching a penny steamer so vigorously that the poor little boat almost sank in the bronze-coloured waves. Now, the truth is that when one has been in a state of mind, as nurses call it, and the tears still stood in Orlando's eyes, the thing one is looking at becomes not itself, but another thing, which is bigger and much more important, and yet remains the same thing. If one looks at the Serpentine in this state of mind, the waves soon become just as big as the waves on the Atlantic, the toy boats become indistinguishable from ocean liners. So Orlando mistook the toy boat for her husband's brig, and the wave she had made with her toe for a mountain of water off Cape Horn. And as she watched the toy boat climb the ripple, she thought she saw Bonthrop's ship climb up and up a glassy wall. Up and up it went, and a white crest with a thousand deaths in it arched over it. And through the thousand deaths it went and disappeared. It's sunk! She cried out in an agony. And then, behold, there it was again, sailing safe and sound among the ducks on the other side of the Atlantic. Ecstasy! She cried. Ecstasy! Where's the post office? She wondered. For I must wire at once to Shell and tell him. And repeating, a toy boat on the Serpentine. And ecstasy, alternately, for the thoughts were interchangeable and meant exactly the same thing, she hurried towards Park Lane. A toy boat, a toy boat, a toy boat, she repeated, thus enforcing upon herself the fact that it is not articles by Nick Green on John Donne, nor 8-hour bills, nor covenants, nor factory acts that matter. It's something useless, sudden, violent, something that costs a life. Red, blue, purple, a spirit, a splash, like those hyacinths. She was passing a fine bed of them. Free from taint, dependence, soilure of humanity or care for one's kind. Something rash, ridiculous, like my hyacinth. Husband, I mean, Bonthrop. That's what it is. A toy boat on the Serpentine. Ecstasy. It's ecstasy that matters. Thus she spoke aloud, waiting for the carriages to pass at the Stanhope Gate, for the consequence of not living with one's husband, except when the wind is sunk, is that one talks nonsense aloud in Park Lane. It would no doubt have been different had she lived all the year round with him as Queen Victoria recommended. As it was, the thought of him would come upon her in a flash. She found it absolutely necessary to speak to him instantly. She did not care in the least what nonsense it might make, or what dislocation it might inflict on the narrative. Nick Green's article had plunged her in the depths of despair. The toy boat had raised her to the heights of joy. So she repeated, "Ecstasy, ecstasy," as she waited to cross. But the traffic was heavy that spring afternoon, and kept her standing there, repeating, "Ecstasy, ecstasy," or "a toy boat on the Serpentine," while the wealth and power of England sat, as if sculptured, in hat and cloak, in four in hand, Victoria and barouche landau. It was as if a golden river had coagulated and massed itself in golden blocks across Park Lane. The ladies held card-cases between their fingers, the gentlemen balanced gold-mounted canes between their knees. She stood there, gazing, admiring, awestruck. One thought only disturbed her, a thought familiar to all who behold great elephants or whales of an incredible magnitude, and that is, how do these leviathans, to whom obviously stress, change, and activity are repugnant, propagate their kind? Perhaps, Orlando thought, looking at the stately, still faces, their time of propagation is over. This is the fruit. This is the consummation. What she now beheld was the triumph of an age. Portly and splendid there they sat. But now, the policeman let fall his hand, the stream became liquid, the massive conglomeration of splendid objects moved, dispersed and disappeared into Piccadilly. So she crossed Park Lane, and went to her house in Curzon Street, where, when the meadow-sweet blew there, she could remember Curlew calling and one very old man with a gun. She could remember, she thought, stepping across the threshold of her house, how Lord Chesterfield had said. But her memory was checked. Her discreet 18th-century hall, where she could see Lord Chesterfield putting his hat down here and his coat down there, with an elegance of deportment which it was a pleasure to watch, was now completely littered with parcels. While she had been sitting in Hyde Park, the bookseller had delivered her order, and the house was crammed. There were parcels slipping down the staircase, with the whole of Victorian literature done up in grey paper and neatly tied with string. She carried as many of these packets as she could to her room, ordered footmen to bring the others, and, rapidly cutting innumerable strings, was soon surrounded by innumerable volumes. Accustomed to the little literatures of the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries, Orlando was appalled by the consequences of her order. For, of course, to the Victorians themselves, Victorian literature meant not merely four great names, separate and distinct, but four great names sunk and embedded in a mass of Alexander Smiths, Dixons, Blacks, Millmans, Buckles, Taines, Paines, Tuppers, Jamesons, all vocal, clamorous, prominent, and requiring as much attention as anybody else. Orlando's reverence for print had a tough job set before it, but drawing her chair to the window to get the benefit of what light might filter between the high houses of Mayfair, she tried to come to a conclusion. And now it was clear that there are only two ways of coming to a conclusion upon Victorian literature. One is to write it out in 60 volumes octavo. The other is to squeeze it into 6 lines the length of this one. Of the 2 courses, economy, since time runs short, leads us to choose the second, and so we proceed. Orlando then came to the conclusion, opening 6 books, that it was very odd that there was not a single dedication to a nobleman among them. Next, turning over a vast pile of memoirs, that several of these writers had family trees 6 as high as her own. Next, that it would be impolitic in the extreme to wrap a 10-pound note round the sugar tongs when Miss Christina Rossetti came to tea. Next, here were 6 invitations to celebrate centenaries by dining, that literature, since it ate all these dinners, must be growing very corpulent. Next, she was invited to 10 lectures upon the influence of this upon that, the classical revival, the romantic survival, and other titles of the same engaging kind. That literature, since it listened to all these lectures, must be growing very dry. Next, here she attended a reception given by a peeress. That literature, since it wore all those fur tippets, must be growing very respectable. Next, here she visited Carlyle's soundproof room at Chelsea. That genius, since it needed all this coddling, must be growing very delicate. And so at last she reached her final conclusion, which was of the highest importance, but which, as we have already much overpassed our limit of 6 lines, we must omit. Orlando, having come to this conclusion, stood looking out of the window for a considerable space of time. For, when anybody comes to a conclusion, it is as if they had tossed the ball over the net, and must wait for the unseen antagonist to return it to them. What would be sent her next from the colourless sky above Chesterfield House, she wondered. And, with her hands clasped, she stood for a considerable space of time wondering. Suddenly she started, and here we could only wish that, as on a former occasion, purity, chastity, and modesty would push the door ajar, and provide, at least, a breathing space, in which we could think how to wrap up what now has to be told delicately, as a biographer should. But no. Having thrown their white garment at the naked Orlando, and seen it fall short by 7 inches, these ladies had given up all intercourse with her these many years, and were now otherwise engaged. Is nothing, then, going to happen this pale March morning to mitigate, to veil, to cover, to conceal, to shroud this undeniable event, whatever it may be? For after giving that sudden, violent start, Orlando— But heaven be praised, at this very moment there struck up outside one of these frail, reedy, fluty, jerky, old-fashioned barrel organs, which are still sometimes played by Italian organ-grinders in back streets. Let us accept the intervention, humble though it is, as if it were the music of the spheres, and allow it, with all its gasps and groans, to fill this page with sound, until the moment comes when it is impossible to deny its coming, which the footman has seen coming, and the maid-servant, and the reader will have to see too, for Orlando herself is clearly unable to ignore it any longer. Let the barrel organ sound and transport us on thought, which is no more than a little boat, when music sounds, tossing on the waves, on thought, which is of all carriers the most clumsy, the most erratic, over the rooftops and the back gardens where washing is hanging to. What is this place? Do you recognise the green, and in the middle the steeple, and the gate with the lion couchant on either side? Oh, yes, it is Kew. Well, Kew will do. So here we are at Kew, and I will show you today, the 2nd of March, under the plum tree, a grape hyacinth, and a crocus, and a bud, too, on the almond tree, so that to walk there is to be thinking of bulbs, hairy and red, thrust into the earth in October, flowering now, and to be dreaming of more than can rightly be said, and to be taking from its case a cigarette or cigar even, and to be flinging a cloak under, as the rhyme requires, an oak, and there to sit, waiting the kingfisher, which, it is said, was seen once to cross in the evening from bank to bank. Wait, wait, the kingfisher comes, the kingfisher comes not. Behold, meanwhile, the factory chimneys and their smoke. Behold the city clerks flashing by in their outrigger. Behold the old lady taking her dog for a walk, and the servant girl wearing her new hat for the first time, not at the right angle. Behold them all. Though heaven has mercifully decreed that the secrets of all hearts are hidden, so that we are lured on for ever to suspect something, perhaps, that does not exist. Still, through our cigarette smoke, we see blaze up and salute the splendid fulfilment of natural desires for a hat, for a boat, for a rat in a ditch, as once one saw blazing. Such silly hops and skips the mind takes when it slops like this all over the saucer and the barrel organ plays. Saw blazing a fire in a field against minarets near Constantinople. Hail, natural desire! Hail, happiness! Divine happiness! And pleasure of all sorts, flowers and wine, though one fades and the other intoxicates, and half-crown tickets out of London on Sundays, and singing in a dark chapel hymns about death, and anything, anything that interrupts and confounds the tapping of typewriters and filing of letters, and forging of links and chains, binding the empire together. Hail even the crude red bows on shopgirls' lips, as if Cupid, very clumsily, dipped his thumb in red ink and scrawled a token in passing. Hail happiness, kingfisher flashing from bank to bank, and all fulfilment of natural desire, whether it is what the male novelist says it is, or prayer, or denial. Hail in whatever form it comes, and may there be more forms, and stranger. For dark flows the stream. Would it were true, as the rhyme hints, like a dream, but duller and worser than is our usual lot, without dreams, but alive, smug, fluent, habitual, under trees whose shade of an olive green drowns the blue of the wing of the vanishing bird when he darts of a sudden from bank to bank. Hail happiness, then, and after happiness, hail not those dreams which blot the sharp image, as spotted mirrors do the face in a country inn parlour. Dreams which splinter the whole and tear us asunder, and wound us and split us apart in the night when we would sleep. But sleep, sleep, so deep that all shapes are ground to dust of infinite softness, water of dimness inscrutable, and there, folded, shrouded, like a mummy, like a moth, prone, let us lie on the sand at the bottom of sleep. But wait! But wait, we are not going, this time, visiting the blind land. Blue, like a match struck right in the ball of the innermost eye, he flies, burns, bursts the seal of sleep, the kingfisher, so that now floods back, refluent like a tide, the red, thick stream of life again, bubbling, dripping, and we rise, and our eyes, for how handy a rhyme is to pass us safe over the awkward transition from death to life, fall on. Here the barrel organ stops playing abruptly. "It's a very fine boy, m'lady," said Mrs. Banting, the midwife, putting her first-born child into Orlando's arms. In other words, Orlando was safely delivered of a son on Thursday, March the 20th, at 3 o'clock in the morning. End of section 16.